Chapter 4 The War on the War on Drugs. No matter how many times you've heard the statistics, they never lose their power to shock. The United States is home to less than 5% of the world's population, but has 25% of its prisoners. Today, the United States incarcerates 5 times more people than it did in 1970. The total number of people incarcerated in state or federal prison rose from 200,000 to 1.6 million between 1972 and 2014. California's incarceration rate quintupled, from about 100 for every 100,000 residents to nearly 500. Between 1984 and 2005, the state opened 21 prisons. The reason, according to Michelle Alexander in her best-selling 2010 book, The New Jim Crow, was drugs. In less than 30 years, the U.S. penal population exploded from around 300,000 to more than 2 million, with drug convictions accounting for the majority of the increase. Between 1980 and 2012, there were an astonishing 43 million drug arrests. The uncomfortable reality, writes Alexander, is that arrests and convictions for drug offenses, not violent crime, are the single most important cause of the prison boom in the United States. But a closer look at the data reveals that just 3.7% of state prisoners are there for nonviolent drug possession, and that 14.1% of state prisoners are locked up for any nonviolent drug offense. 47% of inmates in federal prisons are in for nonviolent drug convictions, but there are just 172,000 people in federal prisons and 1.3 million in state prisons. Over half of all prisoners in state prisons are there for violent offenses like murder, rape, and robbery. During the 1990s and 2000s, an estimated 50% of the increase in state prisoners came from those convicted of violent offenses. 20% of those serving time for drug charges said they had used a firearm in a previous crime, and 24% had a prior conviction for a violent crime, found a 1997 National Survey of State Prisons. It's true that the share of drug offenders in prison rose from 6.5% to 22% between 1980 and 1990. Growing from 20,000 in 1980 to nearly 250,000 by 2010. And nonviolent drug offenses were as responsible for prison growth in the 1980s as violent offenses. But only 20% of prisoners in all jails and prisons are there for drugs. Today, incarceration rates in the United States are at a 30-year low. In 2019, the state and federal imprisonment rate of 419 prisoners per 100,000 U.S. residents was the lowest it had been since 1995, and was a 17% decrease from 2009. The number of people in prisons for drugs alone was never very large. In 1997, just 1% of all prisoners were in for a first or second nonviolent drug offense, and 4% of state prisoners were drug kingpins, people at the mid to high level of drug organizations. The offenses that tend to result in prison time, manufacturing and sales, fell steadily from 350,000 to 208,000 during the same span of time. Of the people convicted of drug offenses, 62% never went to prison, and 1/3 never went to prison or jail. And while 43 million drug arrests between 1980 and 2012 sounds like a lot, over the same period, there were 445 million total arrests, making drugs less than 10% of all arrests. In her preface to the 2020 edition of The New Jim Crow, Alexander acknowledges that drug offenses are not why most people are in prison, but implies that shorter sentences for drug convictions result in a greater churn of people through the prison system than their total numbers would indicate. But that wasn't the case either. During the 2000s, the number of people passing through prison for drug crimes for a single year was only slightly higher than the number of people in prison for drug crimes on any one day. Parole violations are less the result of nonviolent possession and failed drug tests, and more the result of reoffending parolees. 2/3 of those sent back to prison for violating parole had committed a new crime, 60% of which were violent or property crimes, not nonviolent drug crimes. Less than 10% of prisoners surveyed said they had returned to prison for failing a drug test, 6% for possession and 2% for missing a test. Even radical change to drug laws would not significantly affect racial disparities in the prison population. If we released everyone in prison in 2013 whose top charge was a drug offense, notes criminologist John Pfaff, the white percentage would rise by 1 point, from 35% to 36%. The black percentage would fall by 1 point, from 38% to 37%, and the Hispanic percentage wouldn't change. While racial disparity may explain some of the difference in enforcement between white and black people, the disparity between white and Latino people is driven by Latinos tending to deal outdoors. Violence, not stricter drug sentences, drove mass incarceration. New York is proof. For 10 years after Governor Nelson Rockefeller and the state legislature increased penalties for drug use beginning in 1973, the number of people in prison for drugs hardly changed. Then, in 1984, the number of people incarcerated for drug crimes started to rise sharply due to violence associated with the crack epidemic. More than a decade later, in 1997, total inmates in New York prisons for drug offenses peaked and began their long decline, mostly because of a reduction in violence. It was only in 2004 and again in 2009 that the state legislature reduced penalties, and the declining rate of incarceration for drug crimes didn't change after those 2 years. And those who put many of the stricter drug laws into place did so because they were under pressure to protect African American communities suffering from violence associated with gang warfare over open-air crack markets. Notes Pfaff. When prosecutors weren't too concerned about drug crimes, they simply ignored the Rockefeller drug laws. Whether during the rising crime 1970s or the falling crime 1990s and 2000s. Rising incarceration rates reflected rising rates of violent crime. From 1990 to 2010, 2/3 of the increase in inmates nationwide came from people convicted of violent offenses. Some of those convicted of nonviolent offenses may also have committed violent acts, or been with others committing violent acts, but had the charge plea bargained away, notes Pfaff. America's high incarceration rate of African Americans resulted in large measure from concerns among black Americans about rising crime and violence starting in the 1960s. By 1971, African Americans were 2/3 of all people arrested for homicide and robbery, despite being less than 10% of the population. In 1975, black people were murdered at a rate nearly 7 times higher than white people. The Congressional Black Caucus worked with then-Senator Joe Biden, President Bill Clinton, and Senator Bernie Sanders to pass the 1994 crime bill. How racist can a law be which the Congressional Black Caucus vigorously supported and even considered too weak? Asked Columbia University professor John McWhorter. If we had asked these black congresspeople in 1986 why they supported these laws, they would have said that they were aimed at breaking the horror of the crack culture, which had turned inner cities into war zones by the mid-1980s. Drug overdoses are today the number one cause of accidental death in the United States as a result of America's historic addiction and overdose epidemic. Most drug overdose deaths, about 88%, are accidental. 7% are suicides, 4% are of undetermined intent, and 0.2% are homicides. Numbers do not add up to 100% due to rounding. Overdose deaths rose from 17,415 in 2000 to 93,330 in 2020, a 536% increase. Significantly more people die of drug overdoses today than of homicide, 13,927 in 2019, or car accidents, 36,096 in 2019. The overdose crisis is worse in San Francisco than other cities. In Seattle, Phoenix, and Chicago, there were 23, 46, and 48 overdose deaths per every 100,000 people in 2020. In San Francisco, there were 81. Overdose deaths rose from 196 in 2015 to 713 in 2020. Just over half occurred in the Tenderloin, the Intermission, and south of Market. There are about 25,000 injection drug users in San Francisco, a number 50% larger than the number of students enrolled in the city's 15 public high schools. San Francisco gives away more needles to drug users, 6 million per year, than New York City, despite having one-tenth the population. When you walk through the open-air drug scenes in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, Skid Row in Los Angeles, and The Blade in Seattle, you see people of all races and ages injecting and smoking fentanyl, heroin, meth, and other hard drugs right there on the sidewalk near where they bought them. This has been the case to some extent since the 1990s. In the Tenderloin, drugs were everywhere, said Tracy Helton Mitchell, who moved from the Midwest to San Francisco to, in part, maintain her addiction. There was crack on one street, people high on meth on another. People slept anywhere and everywhere on the street. Like many women addicted to hard drugs, Mitchell turned to prostitution. I never thought I would have sex with anyone for money. Heroin made it so easy. But things have grown worse over the last decade. It's the Wild West, said a man who lived in the Tenderloin in June 2020. You hear screams in the night and the sounds of power tools cutting through bike locks all day. The alley has long been a magnet for homeless people and petty drug dealers, but it's never as bad as it is now. The number of people combining opioids and stimulants has grown. I did crack and heroin both, said Tom Wolf. The amount of people using meth and fentanyl at the same time is growing. The combination is known as a goofball. Indeed, the number of opioid-using Americans who also used methamphetamine rose 83% between 2011 and 2017, from 18.8% to 34.2%. Other studies find similar results. Heavy drug and alcohol use degrades the health of homeless people. Drug overdose is the leading cause of death among the homeless. Skin infections and disease are more common due to injecting drugs like heroin and meth. Respiratory diseases are common due to smoking tobacco, crack, heroin, fentanyl, and meth. And about two-thirds of the time of hospital emergency departments in San Francisco is spent serving the homeless. Social scientists who study the homeless in San Francisco describe lives that revolve around addictions. British anthropologist Teresa Gowan published a rich study of San Francisco homeless men who collected and sold aluminum cans and glass bottles for recycling in the mid-1990s and early 2000s. Most of the homeless men who worked as recyclers were indeed heavy users of alcohol or drugs, and they quickly spent their earnings on their cravings, she noted, smoking crack, nodding on heroin, or in a minority of cases, drinking themselves into a stupor. Those who recover from their addictions no longer see homelessness the same way. Once I started to heal myself, said a formerly homeless man, I knew I had to work with this so-called homelessness problem to get some of those people suffering out there into treatment and help them turn their heads around. So-called? Asked Gowan. Ain't no homelessness problem in my opinion, the man replied. The problem is addiction, period. Even those people that have schizophrenia or something else like that, generally you find they have a big problem with addiction as well. few have done more to alter America's drug and crime policies than Ethan Nadelman. I first met Ethan in the mid-1990s when I helped promote decriminalization and harm reduction. It is more due to Ethan than any other individual that America's most progressive cities and states, including California, Washington, and Oregon, have legalized drug possession and phased out mandatory drug treatment. As an undergraduate at Princeton University, he began studying the globalization of drug trafficking and law enforcement. In 1988, Ethan published a long article in Foreign Policy, arguing that the war on drugs was causing more harm than good. He published a 1993 book, Cops Across Borders. Around the same time, The Economist magazine, for the first time, came out saying the same thing, he told me in 2020. Then we're on The Donahue Show, and I'm on Larry King debating former U.S. Senator from New York, Al D'Amato. The front page of The New York Times and Washington Post, and my pictures in Newsweek. I thought it was going to die down, but in fact, it just kept banging away. Over the next several years, Ethan developed the scholarly case for decriminalization and harm reduction. In 1992, he organized 18 leading scholars to co-author a major piece in Daedalus, the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Ethan started bringing together people involved in marijuana legalization, psychedelics, the racist aspects of the drug war, mass incarceration, including people on the European and Australian side, he said. Then the movement was infused with new funding. Around the summer of 92, I get a phone call from George Soros, Ethan said. We had lunch and hit it off. He didn't know what harm reduction was. He was coming at this because he saw how open society ideals were being violated. As a business person and economist, he saw the absurdity of trying to ban a popular commodity. Soros, whose many philanthropic initiatives include drug policy reform, gave Ethan millions in funding to change laws around the country. My interest in harm reduction and decriminalization grew after the November elections of 1996, when Californians, myself included, voted to legalize marijuana for medical use. The more I read on the topic, the more I came to feel that drug prohibition was failing for the same reason alcohol prohibition in the United States failed in the 1920s and 1930s. People addicted to substances would use them even if it meant prison. And prison is the wrong way to deal with what is essentially a disease. Law enforcement had obviously failed to make drugs less available. In the 25 years after 1980, cocaine prices fell by two-thirds in inflation-adjusted terms, even though the number of people arrested and incarcerated increased tenfold. From 1981 to 2012, heroin and meth prices in the United States fell 86 and 72% respectively. Since 2007, heroin street prices have hovered around $300 per gram, in constant 2017 dollars, while wholesale prices have declined from $84 to $53 per gram. The price of meth fell from $10,000 per pound in 2010 to $1,200 to $1,400 per pound in 2019. Meth users in the Central Valley can buy two doses for as little as $2.50 to $5.50. The problem has long been the functionally endless supply of poor farmers in Latin America and Asia willing to produce cocaine and opium poppies, and aspiring criminal entrepreneurs willing to transport and sell it. As such, no amount of law enforcement, short of dramatic curtailments to civil liberties and commerce, in the form of radical border controls, warrantless surveillance, and various other interruptions to daily life, could significantly dent supplies. If drugs were legal and if we treated addiction as a health rather than criminal problem, there would be far less violence and no mass incarceration, I thought. There are no open-air drug markets for insulin. There are no turf wars for antidepressants. Nobody gets shot over a bottle of Chardonnay and a pack of Camel Lights. We would still have problems, but they wouldn't be nearly as widespread as during alcohol prohibition in the United States from 1920 to 1933. Alcohol and tobacco are far more harmful than many drugs, and yet they are legal, I reasoned. In the United States, 88,000 people died from alcohol-related causes in 2018, which is significantly higher than the 72,000 who died from illegal drug overdoses that year. And tobacco is responsible for 480,000 annual deaths in the United States. As President Bill Clinton in the late 1990s considered whether to lift federal restrictions on giving clean needles to drug users, including the homeless, to prevent the spread of HIV and other blood-borne pathogens like hepatitis B and C, I worked with Representative Maxine Waters, a Democrat who represents Watts, a mostly African-American and Latino neighborhood in Los Angeles, to organize civil rights leaders to urge President Clinton to lift the restrictions. For decades, harm reduction and decriminalization advocates have pointed to Portugal as a model, noting that it decriminalized drugs and expanded drug treatment. In 2013, Portugal's drug-induced death rate was 66 times less than that of the United States. The number of people in treatment increased by 60% between 1998 and 2011, with three-quarters receiving an opioid substitute like methadone or Suboxone, the brand name of buprenorphine. Drug use among 15 to 24-year-olds actually declined after decriminalization. All drugs have been legalized, explained Monique Tula, executive director of the Harm Reduction Coalition. Their focus is on giving people tools, like job apprenticeships, and the means to support themselves. Progressive cities and states, including California and Washington, have reformed drug laws. In 2000, California voters passed Proposition 36, a ballot initiative that changed the law so that eligible nonviolent drug offenders could be sentenced to drug treatment and probation instead of jail, prison, or probation without treatment. In 2014, California voters passed Proposition 47, to make 3 grams of hard drugs for personal use a misdemeanor instead of a felony. Proposition 47 also ended jail sentences for people convicted of many nuisance crimes, including possession of 3 grams of hard drugs and shoplifting under $950 worth of property. In June 2020, San Francisco's Board of Supervisors voted to allow nonprofits to operate supervised injection sites where people can use heroin and other hard drugs safely. Several other U.S. cities have sought to create supervised injection sites in recent years, though such facilities remain illegal under federal law. I, like many advocates of harm reduction, compared the death toll from alcohol to deaths from drug overdoses, but the comparison was misleading. Most of the 95,000 people who die from alcohol annually tend to do so after decades of use, while the 93,000 annual drug overdose and poisoning deaths occur within a matter of minutes or hours. Only 2,200 of those annual alcohol deaths occur immediately through acute alcohol poisoning. Much of what I had believed about prohibition was wrong. There is little evidence that it increased the murder rate because the rise in gang violence was offset by fewer non-gang drunken murders. Plus, there were one-third fewer deaths from cirrhosis of the liver during prohibition, and probably less domestic violence. Urbanization increased violent crime for reasons having nothing to do with prohibition. And during prohibition, more cities and counties started reporting homicides for the first time. The fact that the United States has about 4 times as many alcohol abusers as abusers of all illicit drugs put together is further evidence that liberalization increases use. One reason the homeless until the 1980s mostly abused alcohol was that illegal drugs like heroin and cocaine were far too expensive for many of them. As for Portugal, it never legalized drugs, it only decriminalized them, reducing criminal penalties but maintaining prohibition. Drug dealers were still sent to prison even after the 2001 decriminalization. And Portugal does not let people addicted to hard drugs with behavioral disorders off the hook, like progressive West Coast cities have done. It's true that Portugal massively expanded drug treatment, but people are still arrested and fined for possession of heroin, meth, and other hard drugs. And drug users are typically sent to a regionally administered Commissions for the Dissuasion of Drug Addiction, composed of a social worker, lawyer, and doctor who encourage, push, and coerce drug treatment. Portugal is a conservative culture where drug use is looked down upon, said Stanford University psychologist and addiction expert Dr. Keith Humphreys. All of these cities, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, are libertarian in their views about drugs and alcohol. In Portugal, they put pressure on people to go into treatment. It's social pressure and pressure toward making people change their behavior. And decriminalization doesn't end drug violence. Even if trafficking enforcement decreased like it did in Portugal, said criminologist John Pfaff, illegal drug markets would still be forced to rely on violence to resolve disputes. Indeed, prostitution and violence are ever-present in the open-air drug scenes in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Seattle. We are seeing behaviors from our guests that I've never seen in 33 years, said Reverend Andy Bales, who runs the largest homeless shelter on Skid Row in Los Angeles. They are so bizarre and different that I don't even feel right describing the behaviors. It's extreme violence of an extreme sexual nature. People are not dying from drug overdose deaths in San Francisco because they're being arrested. They're dying because they aren't being arrested. Decriminalization reduces prices by lowering production and distribution costs, which increases use. This was also the case for alcohol consumption. It increased after prohibition ended in the United States. Even in Portugal, drug overdose deaths and overall drug use rose after decriminalization. Overall illegal drug use rose sharply over the last two decades in the United States. Heroin use and abuse rose significantly. The number of adults who had ever used heroin rose fivefold from 2001 to 2 to 2012 to 13 to 3.8 million. Found a study of nearly 80,000 people published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The share suffering addiction rose threefold to 1.1 million. Other studies find the same results. RAND Corporation found the number of heroin users nationally rose from 1.6 to 2.3 million. Their spending on heroin rose from $31 to $43 billion. And heroin consumption rose from 27 to 47 million metric tons between 2006 and 2016. Heavy users drive this market, a senior RAND analyst told me. 80% of consumption comes from 20% of the users, which is similar to alcohol. RAND calculates the total U.S. illegal drug market at around $146 billion per year, which is about the same size as the total U.S. market for alcohol. Experts are unsure how many heroin users there are in the United States, and estimates vary significantly. But studies find that there has been a significant increase in usage of heroin and other opiates over the last two decades. The estimated share of 18 to 25-year-olds suffering prescription opioid use disorder or addiction rose 37% from 2002 to 2014. And the odds of heroin use rose fourfold among adults ages 18 to 25 illicitly using prescription opioids, and ninefold among adults 26 to 34 illicitly using prescription opioids over the same period. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health found heroin use disorder doubled between 2002 and 2019. Drugs put a severe burden on society through increased crime, policing, and prisons. Crime rises with drug use in part because addiction makes it hard to maintain a job and because addicts turn to crime to maintain their habit. Researchers in 2017 estimated the cost of heroin addiction alone to be $51 billion annually, or $51,000 per heroin user, an amount calculated by looking at the loss of productivity from death or incarceration, as well as negative health effects associated with heroin. As for heroin maintenance, it is only recommended by experts as a last resort for the tiny subset of heroin addicts for whom methadone or Suboxone does not work. Vicki Westbrook was born in Alabama in 1966 and became the first from her family to graduate from college in 1991 at the age of 25. San Francisco beckoned. A friend of mine from Georgia Tech had moved out to California. One of my IBM friends and a bunch of other friends of mine from high school had moved also to the Bay Area. A few years later, on New Year's Eve, Westbrook took the club drug MDMA, popularly known as ecstasy, with her friends. After the death of her twin, she started to use meth. "I drank some in college, maybe smoked some weed," she said. "That was pretty much it. When I came to California, I discovered acid and hallucinogenics. And then I discovered speed. At the beginning of 1994, I had just started working at tech company Sybase. I'm using this whole time. I was just crazy." "You do crazy stuff when you're an addict, dude. I would be snorting meth off my badge in the bathroom." From the 1990s onward, meth use rose dramatically. Hospital admissions from methamphetamine abuse spiked from over 40,000 cases in 1995 to nearly 130,000 in 2015. In 2017, an estimated 1.6 million Americans used methamphetamine. In 2019, 12.6 million U.S. adults took prescription amphetamines, 4.5 million of whom either didn't follow their physician's guidance or used the drug illegally. San Francisco saw a similar big increase in meth. I asked Kelly Krueger, a San Francisco police sergeant who oversaw the city's responses to psychiatric emergencies, including drug-related ones, for 20 years before retiring in 2021, "Is it just a lot more meth and heroin than there was back in the 1990s? "Very much so," she said. "Every 10 years, the drug of choice changes. In the 60s, it was amphetamines. Right now, we have a lot of them. Bath salts." Synthetic cathinones, also known as bath salts, are a type of lab-made stimulant similar to meth. When they do them, they become aggressive and psychotic. Krueger said harder drugs had attracted a harder crowd. "There was a sense of community among the people on the street in the 80s and 90s," she said. "They looked out for each other more. They camped out in Golden Gate Park, and there were family things. That doesn't seem to be happening as much as far as I can see." Krueger described a homeless man who was abandoned by his friend after overdosing. "His heart stopped and he survived but was brain dead," she said. "The other guy didn't stick around to say his name or anything. I got called by the ICU to do fingerprinting to find the family before they pulled the plug. That used to be rare." Homelessness researcher Chris Herring agreed things had worsened. "It's just so frightening," he said. "It used to be when I started that people were really distinct with their drug use. Now it's like everyone's using everything. It all feels more chaotic. And now with the dropping price of meth, it's really becoming huge on the street." From 2008 to 2020, meth overdose deaths rose 500% in San Francisco, and half of psychiatric visits to San Francisco General Hospital are related to meth. In 2019, meth was the most common drug in California overdose deaths. "Being high on meth looks just like bipolar mania," explained a former psychiatric emergency room doctor. Half of all patients whom he saw at San Francisco General Hospital had both severe mental illness and drug addiction. "Things like methamphetamine and cocaine stimulants will make you psychotic, and so it looks just like bipolar mania," he said. "I mean, it's indistinguishable." Said Krueger, "You probably figured out that folks who are substance abusers are folks who have mental illness and they end up in crisis. In the emergency department, they'll say, he's a speeder. He'll be psychotic, but labeled a speeder because he's doing meth. The mental health department says, we don't have to deal with him because he's on meth. But you still need to deal with him. I asked her what speeders are like. It was always insects, snakes, conspiracy theory, and good or evil, she said. One guy came in and he thought a snake was going up his penis. Another guy torched his car because the snakes were trying to go up his pant leg, and he had to torch the snake. And another guy tried to kill his wife because he thought his wife was having sex with the devil. Proposition 47, which in 2014 decriminalized up to 3 grams of hard drugs, including meth, exacerbated addiction, say drug dealers and law enforcement alike. A meth dealer who had just finished selling to several homeless people in Fresno showed his remaining meth to a reporter while standing on a city sidewalk. He said why he didn't need to be careful. If the cops came right now and found that, all these drugs on us right now, none of us would go to jail. They'd give you a ticket and send you on your way. They'd leave you with your meth. They don't even take it. Though meth's negative health impacts are sometimes sensationalized by the media, they are real. I didn't have any teeth, said Vicky. My teeth are only from here. See the bottoms? We were on Zoom. All my back teeth on the top and bottom were gone from meth. Today, San Francisco has the 4th highest drug overdose death rate of any major city in the United States. In 2020, 713 people died of accidental drug overdoses, a 61% increase from 2019. San Francisco's overdose deaths rose from 11 per 100,000 people in 1985 to 81 per 100,000 in 2020. An over 7-fold increase. Today, drug overdoses are the leading cause of death for non-elderly San Franciscans, accounting for 29% of deaths of residents under 65 in 2019. San Francisco has a long tradition of tolerance toward drug use. During the gold rush of the 1840s, Chinese immigrants opened rooms for smoking opium. Authorities sometimes broke them up, starting in the mid-1860s, but San Francisco's leaders did not ban opium dens until 1875. Opium smoking in San Francisco continued well into the 20th century, but was gradually supplanted by heroin. San Francisco had twice as many alcohol outlets per capita compared to the national average going back at least until the late 19th century, said Stanford's Keith Humphreys. In the 1930s, a stockbroker and a surgeon, both alcoholics, created the 12-step program for achieving and maintaining sobriety that would later become the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. From this emerged the Minnesota model of the 1950s. Its most important innovations were to have former addicts help others with their recovery, to see addiction as a kind of disaffiliation and spiritual alienation, and the creation of individualized treatment plans with the active involvement of families over a 28-day inpatient drug and alcohol treatment. Insurance companies began to reimburse addiction treatment starting in 1964, and by 1987, the American Medical Association, AMA, had declared addiction to be a disease. Local governments, including San Francisco's, created drug courts that allowed judges to sentence many addicts to treatment as an alternative to jail. Drug culture in San Francisco reached a new level during the Summer of Love in 1967. On January 14, 1967, former Harvard professor Timothy Leary and others organized a be-in of between 20,000 and 30,000 people in Golden Gate Park to take LSD and have a spiritual experience. Allen Ginsberg, whose 1955 poem, Howl, is today considered one of the greatest American poems, reminisced that People were walking around in the crowd handing out these tiny white tablets, the most professional-looking and also the strongest LSD tablets yet. The Bien inspired young people from across the United States to travel to San Francisco for the Summer of Love a few months later. Many of the 75,000 young people who flocked to San Francisco that summer experimented with drugs, including marijuana, LSD, cocaine, and heroin. Where most of the white, educated, and upper-middle-class youth left San Francisco after the Summer of Love, poorer and more working-class youth stayed behind and struggled with addiction, crime, and homelessness. Ginsberg may have detected that all was not right at the 1967 Bien. Looking like a cross between Holy Man and Jewish Mother, at 41 years old, Ginsberg played the role of wise elder to baby boomers half his age. As Ginsberg surveyed from the stage the young people in the crowd all taking LSD, he turned to his friend and asked, "What if we're wrong?" In the 1970s, progressives advocated decriminalization as a middle approach between drug prohibition and drug legalization. President Jimmy Carter in 1977 came out for the decriminalization of marijuana and for drug policies to not be more damaging to an individual than the use of the drug itself. The pendulum swung back toward prohibition in the 1980s, particularly among baby boomers, many of whom were settling down and starting families, and among women. President Ronald Reagan increased the U.S. government funding and focus on law enforcement responses to drug dealing. First Lady Nancy Reagan launched the Just Say No campaign, urging children not to use drugs. Efforts in the 1980s to crack down on drugs were partly motivated by the crack cocaine epidemic, which led to increases in addiction, open-air drug markets, and violence by dealers defending their turf. In the 1990s, harm reduction and drug reform advocates began to argue that doctors were unnecessarily under-prescribing pain medications and exaggerating the risk of addiction. Over time, doctors began to view the risk of addiction as overblown. With addicts, their quality of life goes down as they use drugs, one pain doctor told New York Magazine in 2000. With pain patients, it improves. They're entirely different phenomena. Big pharmaceutical companies went far beyond what was medically sound by promoting opioids for chronic, not just acute, pain. Beginning with California, states exempted doctors from lawsuits for prescribing opioids as long as their prescriptions were within the practice of responsible health care. Doctors prescribed opioids in 20% of all patient visits with pain symptoms in 2010, nearly double that of 2000. Opioids became the most prescribed class of drugs, surpassing blood pressure, cholesterol, and anxiety medications. Americans, who represent less than 5% of the world's population, were consuming 80% of the opioids supplied and 99% of the supply of hydrocodone, an opioid pain medication also commonly used as a cough suppressant. After the federal government put in place regulations to restrict pharmaceutical opioids, many users turned to heroin, which was far cheaper. The National Institute of Drug Abuse found in one study that the number of heroin users who had previously taken non-medical pain relievers was 19 times higher than those who did not. A study of young urban injection drug users in 2012 determined that 86% had taken opioid pain relievers non-medically before using heroin. The shift from opioids to heroin can be seen in overdose deaths. The nationwide death rate from prescription opioids was roughly the same in 2019 as in 2010, while the death rate from heroin overdoses soared 430%. Kentucky reported a 278% increase in the rate of heroin deaths from 2010 to 2019, compared to a decline of 31% in prescription opioid deaths. Ohio reported heroin deaths had increased approximately 400% from 2010 to 2016, before falling to 146% of the 2010 heroin death rate in 2019. While many rightly blamed greed on the part of pharmaceutical companies and laziness and corruption on the part of government regulators, the overprescription of opioids was equally due to naive or unskeptical compassion on the part of doctors and the wider society. Harm reduction advocates didn't create the opioid epidemic, but they were part of the same movement starting in the 1990s, urging the softening of restrictions on drugs, including hard ones. In addition to his funding agreement with Soros, Ethan Nadelman raised money from other wealthy Americans, including Lawrence Rockefeller, John Sperling, the creator of the for-profit University of Phoenix, and Peter Lewis, the founder of Progressive Insurance. In 2017, Soros agreed to give $50 million over the next 10 years to Drug Policy Alliance. In 2000, drug reformers led by Ethan successfully campaigned for the passage of California Proposition 36. The Probation and Treatment for Drug-Related Offenses initiative passed with over 60% of the vote. The initiative allowed people convicted of nonviolent drug possession to receive probation and drug treatment instead of incarceration. In 2008, the University of California, Los Angeles published a report about the initiative. Researchers found that Proposition 36 had saved millions of dollars, and that violent crime had declined more in California than nationwide in the preceding 8 years. But the difference in the decline of violent crime was small, 12% in California versus 9% nationally, and could not be attributed to Proposition 36. Moreover, the study found that drug treatment was mostly ineffective with hard drug users, and that arrests for drug and property crimes were higher among Proposition 36 participants than a comparison group of pre-Proposition 36 drug offenders. A study several years later found that Proposition 36 participants, while initially more successful on discharge, were more likely to recidivate within a year than those who had treatment mandated by drug courts. Housing first worsened addiction starting in 2009, say some service providers and law enforcement. It was then that California cities stopped making housing conditional upon sobriety. The housing first harm reduction people said, "Recovery doesn't work," said shelter provider Andy Bales. But it was after that when homelessness exploded. After the passage of Proposition 47 in 2014, police could no longer keep meth-intoxicated speeders in jail for a few days to calm down. "Now we're not having those be crimes where people can be in jail for a couple of days to take a chill," said Kruger. "Instead, they're out breaking into cars and robbing people." Our guests went from 12 to 17% addicted to 50% addicted or higher, said Bales. Said Tom Wolfe, "In 2015, when Proposition 47 took effect, there were 115,000 people homeless in the state of California. Today, there are 165,000. I believe that there is a direct correlation between the two. People that would have maybe cycled through the justice system for committing smaller crimes, like running into Walgreens, filling your backpack full of makeup, and running out because you're a drug addict, might actually have found some help." Between 2016 and 2021, Walgreens closed 17 of its stores in San Francisco due to shoplifting. When a reporter in 2020 asked a clerk where all the merchandise from the empty shelves had gone, he said, "Go ask the people in the alleys, they have it all." Said one homeless man recently, "San Francisco needs to stop sending the message out about the summer of love, because the summer of love is over."